I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. How many times have you read in the paper about another inspiring and hopeful moment in the Middle East conflict? And how many times have you been disappointed by extremists with their guns and bombs and by the leaders who lose sight of peace under pressure of public opinion? Well, this kind of caution is in the back of many minds the day after Israeli Prime Minister and the Palestinian President agreed on what actually is, for both of them, an historic truce. The case is often made that nothing will ever change in this ruthless cycle of hope and despair as long as the people in the nations surrounding this region continue to live without their rights, without democracy. Well, this hour we'll hear from Ramallah and from Jerusalem to see how Palestinians and Israelis are reacting to yesterday's agreement. And we'll talk with the noted human rights advocate from Egypt, Saadeddine Ibrahim. We'd also like to hear from you. What do you think it will take to make peace stick this time round? Does it require tougher measures to deal with extremists on the inside or a greater push for democracy in the region? And what kind of role can the United States play? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We start this morning in Jerusalem with David Horowitz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. I ask David if Israelis are in any way optimistic about this truce.
I think there's a very, 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 very cautious degree of optimism. Relatively speaking, in the months leading up to this summit, things were already calmer. Mahmoud Abbas had deployed troops to discourage, although not to confront, people who had been firing rockets into Israel and so on. And there'd still been some of that. But as I say, there's very cautious optimism that it might hold.
When we survey the prospects then, or I should say when people in Israel survey the prospects, do they really just look at the difference between the leaders, the fact that this time around it is Mahmoud Abbas and it's not Yasser Arafat?
At the moment, I think for most Israelis, there's been a tactical shift, which is you now have Abu Mazen and Mahmoud Abbas saying that violence is counterproductive. Unfortunately, yesterday at the summit, he didn't say what he'd said a year and a half ago, which was that terrorism is wrong and actually call it terrorism and vow to root it out. But I think Israelis will truly begin to feel justified optimism if they see his talk of Palestinians achieving their aims under one authority and with one bearer of arms, which is something he did say at the summit. In other words, if he acts to prevent terrorism in the future rather than merely negotiating a temporary respite with groups that are avowedly, publicly, cheerfully committed to Israel's destruction, like Hamas.
And what about Israeli support for the action of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon? I mean, if this goes ahead as planned, then hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are to be released, perhaps as early as next week. Is the Prime Minister risking public support by going this far?
The Prime Minister is risking a great deal of support from his natural constituency with everything that he's been doing for the past year and a half. He has become a new Ariel Sharon. This is a new incarnation of Ariel Sharon, a man who a few short years ago urged Israeli Jews to grab more hilltops in the territories so that no future prime minister could relinquish that land, has now become the very prime minister that he warned against to forcibly, if necessary, remove up to 8,500 Jews from their homes. That is an incredibly controversial policy. Right. At the moment, he's surviving politically, although sometimes by the skin of his teeth. So prisoner releases, yeah, fairly controversial, but nothing compared to the much wider controversy provoked by so dramatic a shift in Ariel Sharon's fundamental stances.
Would you say that all it would really take is one extremist with a gun or one person with a bomb on a bus to take Israel and the Palestinians back to where they were in 2002 or 2003?
If Sharon feels that Abu Mazen's people are failing to prevent terrorism, then yes, one suicide bombing, one major terrorist attack, it would shatter even the very faint optimism. But I would stress that if there is a sense in Israel that Abu Mazen is serious, that he's prepared to confront Hamas, that he's trying to stop terrorism, and nonetheless a bomber or a gunman gets through, I think this Ariel Sharon would be horrified by such an attack. But if he felt that he had a partner who was trying to stop those attacks, it wouldn't necessarily spell the end of everything. In other words, Sharon would not allow the fragile hopes of something better to be exploded by a single bomber, but those hopes would be exploded if he felt that his Palestinian counterpart wasn't trying to stop those bombers.
David, I thank you for your time.
Thanks.
David Horowitz is editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Now, Palestinians are also guarded in their reactions. Sanad Sahelia is a reporter and photographer for Al-Quds Daily and for Reuters. He joined us from Ramallah to talk about the view on the summit from the other side of the fence.
Too much things happened in Israel and Palestinian relationship since the election of Mahmoud Abbas. But in the same time, the Palestinians compare between this meeting, which happened in Sharm el-Sheikh, and the other meetings in the past. And there are many lessons for the Palestinians to be learned from Oslo process. The most vital element of a renewed political process is security. And now, for example, Hamas said the Palestinian issue is not a security thing. But in Sharm el-Sheikh, they talk about just the security. Everything is linked to security, the release of the prisoners, the freedom of movement for the people and the goods.
Sanad, let me interrupt you there, because this question about Hamas seems to me to be a very central one. I'm reading in the news this morning Hamas leaders saying that they will not support this truce. Does that mean that nothing will change?
Yes, of course, because now all the Palestinian parties, the Islamic and the left parties, they think that Sharm el-Sheikh didn't bring anything for the Palestinian people. What happened in Sharm el-Sheikh has happened before. And they, all the Palestinian parties don't want to link the security situation with the other important things for them.
So now, does that mean that there's just going to be more suicide bombs, more rockets, more shooting?
Not exactly that, but I think the Palestinian parties, especially the Islamic parties, they didn't agree with the with PNA to stop the this military operations. But they giving her a chance to do something. But if Israel didn't do anything on ground, if they didn't stop the assassination, if she didn't stop the curfew, and Hamas will do again the military operation, it will be back.
Sanad, does that mean that people in the Gaza Strip, people in the West Bank, they're going to wait and see? They're going to maybe stop the attacks on Israeli settlements
for a while.
And what do they need to see? What's the one thing that they want to see so they believe that maybe something is really going to change for them?
I said it before, to release all the prisoners, to have freedom of movement inside the West Bank and between West Bank and Gaza, and the most important thing, to stop assassinations. That's the most important thing.
And do the people in the Palestinian territories also want something from America? Do they want something from Egypt and from Jordan? Do they want help and assistance from outside?
Yes. All the Palestinians want, especially from the United States, to be to move side by side with the Palestinians and the Israelis. They know well that nothing will happen on ground if the United States didn't support this. They know that.
Sanad, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Sanad Sahelia is a reporter and photographer with Al-Quds Daily and with Reuters. Let's turn now to Saad Eddin Ibrahim. He is a sociologist and human rights activist and is president of Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies, joining us from NPR studios in Washington. Saad, it's nice to have you back on the program.
It is my pleasure to be here, Dick.
We're hearing so much caution and suspicion from the people in the region, and yet where you are now, the Washington Post says this is the most inspiring and hopeful moment in more than 4 years of conflict. What are you thinking this morning?
Well, I agree with the Washington Post. I think this is a moment to cheer, and we have to be cautious in our optimism. But optimism is the title this morning. And I think coming in the aftermath of several other positive events, like the election in Iraq and the election in Palestine, there is something to look forward to. I think the region is changing, and I have a feeling that something is being born, and that is probably a stable, peaceful process underway.
Saad, you have written in the past that if there is to be any real change in relations between Israelis and Palestinians, there also has to be real change in the politics of the nations surrounding the region. More freedom, more democracy, for example, in a place like Egypt. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, the chances are always good. Otherwise, we wouldn't be activists. Activists always believe that change is possible and change is doable. And that's why we are activists. Now, the link between democracy, human rights, and peace is very important to highlight, because often people who do not have a voice at the table could never be counted on to endorse or to honor any agreement that's done by their leaders. So the fact that Mahmoud Abbas is democratically elected and with a good margin gives him the authority, the moral authority, to speak on behalf of the Palestinians and, in fact, to marginalize for the time being organizations like Jihad and Hamas. Now, if he delivers, I think the marginalization may end up being a continuous state. In other words, he can either bring them back to be partners in the political process in the Palestinian Authority or to write them off. And he will have the endorsement and support of his own public opinion.
All right, Connection listeners, I need to just interrupt you for half a second there, Saad. We're going to take a break. Question for you, what comes first? Is it a democracy and freedom in the Palestinian territories in that particular conflict? Or does that also need the kind of support that it would get from democracy and freedom for people in places like Egypt and Syria and Jordan? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to test your optimism today as we take stock of the latest news from the Middle East and look at it in a slightly broader context. Is it simply a matter of focusing specifically on the region and the conflict there, or does it make more sense to pull the lens back a little bit and take a look at the surrounding countries? Saad Eddine Ibrahim is with me. He's a sociologist and a human rights activist whose own opposition to the President of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, got him accused of disseminating false information harmful to Egypt's interests and got him 3 years incarceration. He served 3 years of a 7-year sentence of hard labor. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington to give us his take on what's happening in that region. And Saad, I want to go back, if I can, to a phrase that we often hear about news from that region. You've heard it, and I've heard people saying that the road to peace in all of the Middle East starts in or leads through Jerusalem or Gaza City. How much does it also go through Damascus and Beirut and Cairo? How much do those centers matter now?
Well, everybody in the Middle East matter in one sense, that it's very easy to derail the process by any disgruntled extremist or a demagogue. And therefore, we have to approach these issues in an integrated fashion. And we have argued all along that peace and democracy are two sides of the same coin. Peaceful forces are working very hard for not only democracy in their own countries, respective countries, but also for the peace in the region as a whole, and knowing that you could not have one without the other for very long. You can sign a peace agreement, but if it's not followed by democracy, then the democracy, the peace itself is undermined. And we have seen that several times. You mentioned, and your guests from Jerusalem and or Tel Aviv and Ramallah substantiated that we have had moments like yesterday several times in the past. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that this was not coupled with democratization of the respective parties to sustain whatever the leaders sign. And therefore, I am urging everybody who's concerned about our region to, as much as they push for peace and stability, they also should push for democracy and development. Okay. These are three things that must go hand in hand.
But let's look at what happens when that's tried directly. And your case is as good as any in when we talk about this. Even when you're in the United States and talking about the importance of democracy, say, for example, in Egypt, the Egyptian newspapers attack you for being a stooge of the president of the United States. They don't ever evaluate what you're saying. They simply put you on the side of the bad guys. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course. But the reason for that is that our media is state-controlled. And it is state-controlled because we don't have democracy. So it is the chicken and the egg. So long as you have an authoritarian regime that controls the media, wants to be the only sole voice coming from Egypt, any other voice is always dismissed as a lackey of the United States. Even though Hosni Mubarak, who directs this kind of smear campaign against me, claims that he's a strategic ally of the United States. Mm-hmm. But he wants to be the only party that deals with the United States and with the outside world, which is okay, fine, if he can also be accountable to his own people. So that is really the issue. Luckily, through independent media like NPR and like Arab satellites outside Egypt, I have been able to get my voice through. And people who listen to me know who is sincere and who is demagogic. And I am sure I am the sincere one.
I wonder if you can, though, make that link even more clear to those of us who are trying to figure out what's going on there. Imagine along with me, if you would, a young man sitting in Gaza City wondering whether or not he should stand in support of Mahmoud Abbas and this truce, or wondering if he should continue his support for Hamas and the militant opposition to Israel. We know there are people who are facing this decision right now. This young man looks at what's happening in Cairo. He sees Hosni Mubarak basically keeping the human rights advocates and the democracy advocates pushed down. What difference would it make to him if he saw change in the regions outside his own?
Well, it probably would be very hard to convince a young man in Gaza that what happens in Egypt has a direct bearing on his own present and future. But let us continue with this young man sitting in Gaza. I think if he sees things on the ground, if Mahmoud Abbas can deliver, more prisoners are released, more roads are open, few attacks by the Israelis, targeted assassination and so on, he will sense a difference. And he will know that Mahmoud Abbas is speaking on his behalf and for the well-being of the Palestinians. Now, part of Mahmoud Abbas's authority is the fact that he was democratically elected. And that message must be conveyed. We have reasons to believe that the Camp David 2000 was torpedoed not by Arafat alone, but also by several Arab leaders who saw a peace breaking into the region as a threat to their regimes, because the Palestinian question and the Arab-Israeli conflict has been used for so long by authoritarian leaders as an excuse to ward off any call for democratization. That is a link. It is hard to bring it alive to a young man in Gaza right now, but in a few months from now, if he sees results from an elected leader like Mahmoud Abbas, and if there is any problem that comes on the road to peace, which we anticipate there will be a lot of hurdles, I think there should be a formula by which people can speak their voice, can speak their mind on it.
But it's this great contradiction that you look at the choices currently facing Hosni Mubarak. He can stand in support of Mahmoud Abbas, who is a democratically elected leader. He can say, you need to support this man with everything that you have at your disposal. Then you've got people in Egypt saying, wait a second, our president is saying support this man because he's democratically elected, and we don't even have that opportunity here. And the whole thing seems to kind of unravel at that point because people are trying to figure out where the truth really lies.
Well, the truth lies in the call for peace and the call for democracy. It is not; it should not be either or. Some of our leaders have in the past, and probably some of them continue, to make it either or to say often that the Palestinian question first. And the Palestinian question is a very emotive issue all over the Arab and the Muslim world. And any leader can exploit that issue cynically to delay any other reform by saying, well, you know, no voice should be louder than the voice for the liberation of Palestine.
Right.
And by using that slogan, they have sometimes put the democratic advocates in a corner and tried to show them as if they do not care for the Palestinians or for the so-called pan-Arabism. So we have been used now to this language, to these tactics for nearly 50 years, but more and more people are seeing through it. So yes, if Mubarak can play a role in bringing the parties together and hosting a meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, fine, great, we'll applaud him for that. But in the same time, we should not overlook that this ought not to be a price for continuing authoritarianism as usual.
He can't say, I'm a peacemaker, so obviously everything I'm doing is right. I'm going to continue with business as usual in Cairo.
That is what we are saying should not be done. And we should call him on it. And that's why we are challenging him in the presidency this year.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, this hour, a chance to take a look at the Middle East conflict through a slightly different angle, and that is through the state of the democracy of the nations surrounding the Palestinians and the Israelis. What difference would it make if, in fact, there was greater freedom for people in places like Egypt, in places like Syria? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to go to Virginia Beach, Virginia, for our first call. And Shad's joining us. Hi, Shad.
Hi, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Great. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the point of being recognized by the surrounding states and governments. But, you know, a Palestinian that's from Palestine is not even acknowledged worldwide. It's not something that's found on a map. The United States doesn't even acknowledge it as a state. So what does that do to us, to the psyche of a Palestinian who democratically elected their leader? And mm-hmm. It's not an actual state. It's just a temporary body to lead to where. It doesn't give a definitive future for it. So the person that's sitting in the coffee shop in Gaza says, well, let's give this a shot. Let's see how we can bring about some change. But I think if it goes on a few months on the same course, I mean, let's face it, us as Americans, we're proud of our country. We can look on a map and there it is, clearly defined, clearly with democratic values. A Palestinian, how would they look at it? Would they look at it as what exactly?
Well, Shad, I mean, you see the dilemma for people on both sides. One of the principal disagreements is over exactly what the borders would be. Where will the lines be drawn? How do you get beyond that to a state? Is that something that needs to be done with the assistance of outside countries? I'll go to Saad Ibrahim with that, but Shad, I'd like to know your thoughts on it.
Absolutely. In the United States and in the United Nations, you can't have a country that's not recognized internationally. It eventually will not survive. You'll see cases like Iran and other countries that are isolated. Maybe they survive, but not as a starting country, not as a country like Palestine or a future Palestine. You need the help of the superpowers of mm-hmm. the world. You can't just leave it to the powers that be. You can't just have it. Basically, you have to take the leading role. You have to take the initiative and say, well, we need to try to fix it. I'm not saying there's a silver bullet to fix borders and situations. However, think of it from a Palestinian's perspective. If you're sitting in that Gaza coffee shop, your family is starving, they're hungry, you want a job, you want economic reform, you want to be able to support your family. But
you also want to be able to define what it is you're proud of, if it is a country that you're proud of. Saad Ibrahim, the question of borders is one that you know bedevils people on all sides of this argument. When Shad is talking about getting greater involvement of the United States and great powers in to sort out some of those thorny issues so there can be borders, so there can be the national pride. Do you see that as something that's within reach?
Yes, of course. That's what we're all working for. And that's what all the parties claim to be working for. The question is really on the details, and that they say the devil is in the details. But there is a core Palestinian homeland that nobody is disputing right now, and that is in Gaza and the West Bank. And then there are the settlements, there is a wall. These are at the edges of the Palestinian homeland. But the core of the Palestinian country is already known to all parties. And wherever you have Palestinian majority population in a community, that ought to be part of Palestine. And whenever you have a community that is a majority Jewish population, that is probably already de facto part of Israel. So the major elements of defining what is a country are there. What Chad is talking about, and I think he has a point, is the legal international recognition. And that is still in the making, and I hope it will come quickly, because as I said earlier in the program, if the parties drag their feet for too long, any extremist or fanatic from either side can jump to the center stage and derail the whole process. And we have seen that 3 or 4 times in the past.
Okay, but if I ask you just one more practical question, right now, when we look at the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, it's now seen by many people as a place where Egyptians smuggle arms in to allow the Palestinians to continue their struggle. What's the message to the Egyptians? What should they be doing?
Well, when you talk about Egyptians, you don't know what Egyptians you are talking about. Is this the Egyptian government?
Right.
These are sympathizers with the Palestinian resistance. Is it the Egyptian intelligence? We don't know. The facts are not known. But that border ought to be guarded and sealed and guarded in a very responsible way by the Egyptians and the Israelis as well. There's no doubt about that. I would not endorse or condone any smuggling of arms across borders when it leads to illegal acts or inhuman acts like the use of terrorism against civilians. That is very clear in my own mind, right, and in the mind of many people who may not have the opportunity to express themselves.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Next call from Raleigh, North Carolina, and Mohammed's with us. Hi there.
Yes, I have a comment and a question for your guest. And my comment first is my heart was really full of joy when I saw Prime Minister Sharon and Abbas sitting together on a table and talking with the Palestinian connection, Arab worlds, and Israeli connection in the Western world. I think the economic potential of this area is just huge. And and once the well-being of everybody is realized because of economic development, I don't really think it's going to matter, 100 acres here or there eventually. That was my comment. It's just going to take a vision on both leaders to make this happen and stick to the road. The question I have for your guest is the Egyptian election, and he mentioned that he's challenging it in the fall when it happens. I just find it difficult to see how that's going to happen. I mean, status quo going to prevail? You're going to have the maybe not 90% approval, but 85% approval or whatever. It's very hard to challenge, election when the media is controlled by government.
And also, Mohammed, when the president himself points to all opposition parties and leaders and says, none of them have support. I'm the only one who has support.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your guest answer. How would you challenge something like that?
You know what I'm going to do? We're going to get to that when we come back after a break, because we're just coming up to one of those. It's an important question. I don't want to rush Saad on that. But it's at the very heart of what we're talking about this hour. The political change is not going to happen just in that one little place between Israelis and Palestinians. If it's going to stick, most observers say it's got to happen in Egypt. It's got to happen in Saudi Arabia. It's got to happen with the pushing and the urging of the United States as well. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you on whether or not you think that's likely, whether or not the U.S. is willing to put its shoulder to that wheel, as well as getting back involved in the Arab-Israeli conflict. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Slightly broader assessment of the news from the Mideast yesterday on the truce agreed between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Does, in fact, the United States need to get more involved in dealing with the peripheral countries, confronting Saudi Arabia, confronting Hosni Mubarak, president of Egypt? Mohammed raises the question from Raleigh, North Carolina, about our own guest, Saadeddine Ibrahim, who's a sociologist and human rights activist, president of the Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies in Cairo, and a candidate, I believe, Saad, for president in the Egyptian elections this fall. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, Washington's a funny place to campaign for that.
No, we are campaigning for change the constitution first, because Egypt, here I have to take a minute to explain to our audience, has one of the strangest constitutions in history, a constitution that requires 2/3 majority of the deputies, of the members of parliament, just to get your name on any ballot. Can you believe this? To have 2/3 majority of the parliament to be able to get your name considered?
Well, no wonder only one name ever gets put on the ballot.
Exactly. So we are first demanding to do away with this very strange articles in the Egyptian constitution, and then to challenge Mubarak to a real contest, to a free and open election. And so what I have done, and other people have followed me, is to challenge Mubarak for an open contest. If he really thinks that the people want him, let the people speak their mind in a free and open election. And by the way, let us go back to our topic here, because Egyptians who went to observe the Palestinian election, including delegates from the Ibn Khaldun Center, as well as from the government, official delegation went to observe the election, they all came back very impressed by how transparent and how fair and honest the election in Palestine was. Same thing happened in Iraq. We sent delegations, international observers have all reported the same thing. So the call in Egypt in the opposition paper and among civil society advocates is that if two countries like Palestine and Iraq could have free and honest election, why can't we in Egypt? And here is a connection. The connection is we should not accept any false trade-offs, like a role played by Mubarak in bringing about the parties for a peace process in Sharm el Sheikh should not be used as a bargain with either the internal forces or the outside community, the outside world, to justify tyranny as usual, or the continuation of despotic rule. And we have to be very clear about this. Any peaceful agreement that's not arrived by democratically elected people becomes very tenuous, very unstable, very shaky.
I wonder if Mohammed is still with us in Raleigh. Are you there?
Yeah. Yes, I am. And I think in general, this sounds good. But if you look at nuts and bolts of how would you go about this, obviously need some members in the parliament who can push for change the constitution. And actually, I know of a case that happened recently where somebody was put in jail just for raising that issue.
This was Ayman Nour, the head of the Tomorrow Party in Cairo?
That's correct.
Yeah.
So that's one. I mean, it sounds like your guests, of course, have the right idea and the right approach. But if you look at the nuts and bolts, the mechanism.
But, Mohammed, let me ask you from your perspective, as an observer watching from this country, you know what's being reported here. You know that, you know, everybody could see in their morning paper Abbas and Sharon shaking hands across the table. But what Saad is talking about is saying, you know, people in the United States need to understand that pushing for freedom, pushing for democracy in those more difficult countries like Egypt may be equally important. And I'm wondering, Mohammed, if in your view that message is getting through.
Yes, and I think, of course, as your guest pointed out, it's not either or. It has to be, you know, going together. And I think, you know, our country, the U.S., can exert pressure on a country like Egypt and Saudi Arabia to actually cause or push these leaders toward allowing, you know, democracy to take hold. We hold, you know, we give U.S. aid. We have, you know, U.S. military, and we have lots of cards to play as far as being in the U.S. We're not playing them.
Yeah, let me go back to Saad on that point, if I can, because we talked earlier about the young man in Gaza looking at the world around him, and I'm wondering if we were to speak to the same 22-year-old young man sitting in a cafe in Cairo today. He sees or he hears President Bush talking about democracy, but what does he really want?
Well, he basically wants a good future.
I mean, a job. That's
a
not...
job, a prospect for a career, to form a family of his own if he's young, and to breathe freedom. Now, half of the Egyptian youth under 30, according to a recent survey, want to migrate out of the country for not only for jobs, but for freedom, for a democratic society. And here is the key, and I think that's where Muhammad probably has a very important point, is that countries like the United States that has so much leverage over authoritarian regimes like Mubarak's regime or like the Saudi regime must use its influence, its power, the assets that it has in foreign policy to persuade gently these friendly regimes to begin to democratize, to open up the system, to allow freedom of the press, for example, to allow the rule of law to take hold, to restore the independence of judiciary. Some of these elements are building blocks into a democratizing these countries and democratizing the region. And let me emphasize again that is only when you have democratic government, then you can really trust any peace agreement that will be concluded to stick and to survive.
All right, Connection listeners, what you're hearing from our guest this hour is that it is perhaps not enough to push for, lobby for, offer American general support for democracy just in the Palestinian territories, but also to push for that in countries that aren't used to hearing that kind of message from the White House. So what kind of resolve does that take? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'd like to have you join us. We're going next to Amherst, New York, and John's with us. Hi there, John.
Hi, Dick. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Saad, I wish you Godspeed and good luck because you are going to need it. Mubarak has saved himself some sort of fiefdom there where it's very difficult and it's not a democracy. I don't think there's much of an advantage for any of these so-called democracies, such as in little fiefdoms, the Jordan and everything, to have a resolved Palestinian conflict. If there is troubles out there, and these poor people, they can blame it on the Jews, and they have done it, and I'm not trying to be derogatory. But my point in calling was that your other guest, every time I hear someone speaking about a process, the roadmap, they always couch it. Your guest couched it in, well, if we don't get something in a few months, well, I will promise you that this peace will be broken, in that case, by the Palestinians. The Israelis have everything to gain. And the fact is that there are more Palestinians who are better off because of the benevolence of Jews than they are of the benevolence of their Arab neighbors and the Palestinian Authority up to now.
You spend any time in the refugee camps of Gaza, though, and those deadlines start to take on a little bit more meaning, John, you know, the kid who hasn't worked for 3 years and is tempted to pick up a weapon and join Hamas, maybe 3 months does make a difference. Maybe the clock is ticking.
Well, Dick, that's all well and good, but we are not baking a souffle here. Now, if we look back to where Israel offered Palestinian 98% of the pre-67 boundaries and it was just dismissed,
yeah.
I believe that train has left the station. And if we're going to have preset conditions, And I am telling you that Mubarak has no desire, nor does he have any incentive to have a resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli situation because he can deflect to it. And this happens continually. And I do fear that it's going to happen again. And once again, Saad, Godspeed, God bless you, and I really hope you are successful. There's no reason why Arabs should not be free like the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you a lot, John. So, did you want to respond to that?
Well, yes. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank John for his warm feeling toward me. But I also would like to just warn him against talking about the Palestinians in general or the Israelis in general. Because it is not the Israelis who do this or that. The Palestinians as a whole do not do this or that. But there are individuals, there are groups, there are parties, there are leadership on both sides. And what happened, and as I see it, in Camp David 2000, is that a Palestinian leader and possibly two other Arab leaders like Hosni Mubarak and Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia drag their feet on concluding or supporting Yasser Arafat to accept the deal. And I agree with him. I think that was a historical opportunity that was wasted. It was not the Palestinians who wasted it. It was Arafat, Mubarak, Abdullah, and Barak. And let us be clear about that. Otherwise, we fall into racism, as if all the Palestinians one thing, all the Israelis one thing, all the Egyptians, all the Arabs.
Right.
This is the kind of thing we should be very careful.
Your message is, I guess, that if we were to go back through history to look at the two Camp David Accords and the Oslo Accord and the Geneva Accord and the roadmap, that there is from all those a pretty deep reservoir of goodwill, people who still want to take the best of those and use it as a foundation?
Yes. And yet, there are always elements who have no interest in resolving the conflict, as John said. And these elements are not just individuals, but they're also leaders in the region. And that is, these leaders invariably are authoritarian leaders. They don't want this issue to go away,
right?
Because people will turn and say, all right, let's then get back to the democratic and the political agenda.
Let's hear from Charles, who's joining us now from Virginia Beach. Hi, Charles. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. My thought is that particularly all the Muslim countries, whether in the Middle East or wherever, tend to look at democracy as a westernization, which, according to the Islamic religion, doesn't seem to fit in well. So how do you reconcile, or how do we reconcile trying to introduce democracy in a country, in those countries where the religions is such an integral part of the way of life, and there are many, many followers. So it would seem to me we're like pouring water on a rock, trying to erode the rock, when the to introduce democracy, we'd have to come from within the country. Putting it in there from outside isn't going to convert the Islamic people to wanting to be westernized. And,
what do you think, son?
Charles... I hope you listened to what I said in comment on John's intervention, is that you don't talk about the Muslims or the Islamic world. Let me remind you that two-thirds of the Muslim world are living under democratically elected governments. You probably did not know that, but you listen to people who spread these kind of stereotypes over generalizations to say that there is something that Islam and democracy do not have going for them. This is totally false. It was said, the same thing was said about Catholic countries. It was said about Germans. It was said about Japanese. It was said about the Slavs. So be careful, Charles, to condone or spread or to repeat this kind of stereotypes.
But Charles, there's another part of what you were asking that I think is key, and that is, does it come from within, or can it be imposed from another country? Because it's the imposition of something that's unwelcome by the leaders that seems to be what people are pushing back against. Have I got that right, Charles, the point that you're making on that?
Yes. It's the religion is such an integral part of the culture, the heritage, the tradition. So to change that. And if you have democracy, you ought to be able to practice any religion you want. Well, if religion is that has that big an impact on the society, how do you change that from without? I think that that's the wrong, well, it's the hard way to do it, the hardest way to do it.
You're listening to The Connection. Saad, this is one for you. I mean, once again, are we talking about religion or are we just talking about old habits that need changing?
Well, he's talking about old habits that need changing. That has nothing to do with religion because I said 2/3 of the Muslim world today, there is 1.3 billion Muslims in the world today. 2/3 of them are living under democratically elected countries. And I want to repeat and overemphasize this point to Charles. That's one. The other point, I think that I agree with him, democracy or any way of life could not be imposed from the outside or superimposed from above. It has to come from the people themselves. And that applies to Muslims as well as it applies to any people in the world, to Americans themselves.
Okay, but you have been quite congratulatory of President Bush in saying, look, we'll do anything that we can to try and bring democracy to these countries. Does he cross the line? Is it too much of imposing rather than encouraging?
If there's questions to me, I tell you what. What I've asked the Bush administration is only to refrain from supporting dictators. We are not asking him to come and impose democracy by the gun or by the tank or by the plane, but to stop inviting Hosni Mubarak to the White House. Simple gesture like that.
And it would make a difference, would it?
It would make tremendous difference because these dictators, some of them have been living off the generosity of the U.S. for so long. Let me give you an example. Egypt, for example. Hosni Mubarak has been receiving $2 billion every year from the American, different successive American administrations.
Yeah.
What kind of a message? That means endorsement of a dictatorial regime. Now, why does the U.S. do this? Bush, according to Bush, it was done in the past because of Cold War considerations, strategic considerations.
Which are no longer there.
Why do you keep cuddling the man and his regime and giving him this support and conveying to him that, you know, we will continue to do business with you?
These are all great questions. We'll talk about them on future programs. Saad, I want to thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Dick.
Saad Eddine Ibrahim is a sociologist and human rights activist and president of Ibn Khaldun Center for Development Studies. Earlier in the program, we talked with Sanad Sahelia, a journalist for Al-Quds Daily and Reuters, based in Ramallah, and David Horowitz, who's editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.